Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. Once again, this is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 28th of April, 2013. This is not a nav briefing. Rather, this is an audio commentary to accompany the crew notes number 23, which are entitled Upgrading the Fallen Goddess Scenario. And you will find those crew notes in the form of a new piece on metahistory.org entitled Myth in Progress. So the link to that is provided. I have sent out a notice to the new and trimmed down crew list, the distribution mailing list. I have sent out a notice with a link to this page. Now, I'm not going to read this page paragraph or this essay paragraph by paragraph as I comment on it, but I will read some paragraphs and I will elaborate on some of the points that I'm making here. As you know from the previous briefing, we are in the stage of developing FGS 3.0. That is to say, the Fallen Goddess Scenario, as we call it traditionally. And we are in the third version. And I must say that my realizations over the past couple of weeks or even couple of days regarding the progress of this myth have been startling and stunning. So I feel great excitement and urgency about the development of the Sophianic narrative at this time in correction and at this time indeed in the history of our benighted species. And I hope to convey some of that excitement and urgency to you in the course of this audio commentary. Just want to specify again that you can reach this audio commentary through a link provided on metahistory.org, and you can also reach it, of course, from gaiaspora.org if you go to the section GNE Audio Files. So, before I begin, let me make one small correction regarding statements I made in a recent briefing. Mitosis and meiosis. I can't tell you how many times I have scrambled to get these two terms straight. When I was writing Not in His Image, and during those years and even before, while I was writing on metahistory.org about the mysterious business, let's call it the conundrum of human reproduction, I had occasion to refer to these two forms of biological activity. And I always got them backwards, and I appear to have done that again in a recent briefing. So let me really make it clear for the last time and clear to myself as well, whether I'm talking about mitosis or meiosis. In the first place, I see now why the confusion happens in my mind, because both mitosis and meiosis involve cell division. And I had erroneously thought that only meiosis involves cell division, but that is not true. So they both involve cell division, but different types of cell division. So let's be clear from this point on, and let's see if I can finally get this right. Meiosis, M-E-I-O-S-I-S, is the form of sexual reproduction in which two parents give rise to an offspring through a genetic combination provided by each parent. So each parent gives one half of his or her genes to the offspring. This is obviously the form of human production, human reproduction. Two human animals, male and female, engage in a sexual conjugation. And by meiosis, they produce an offspring. By contrast, mitosis is that form of reproduction in nature which occurs when a cell or organism such as an amoeba splits itself in half and forms out of a single mass and a single entity, forms two daughter cells, which then in turn split in half, and so forth and so on. That is mitotic reproduction. So, the premise that I am developing along with you in regard to this mysterious conundrum of human sexuality is as follows. In Sophia's original dreaming from the Pleroma, when she pictured an experiment for Anthropos 10, she did picture the species as being gendered, but she did not picture them as reproducing meiotically as we do today, but rather reproducing mitotically, or in some variation of mitosis that might in certain respects resemble meiosis, but not to the point in which meiosis actually occurs today, that is to say, biological reproduction through the unity of sperm and ovum. So what you want to picture in your mind tentatively, because this is a deep, deep subject that needs to be explored and clarified, obviously, but what you want to picture in your mind is something like a variation of mitosis in the human animal, wherein we would reproduce ourselves through the generation of the double. And this mysterious business of the double is one of the most obscure and troubling topics in the whole realm of the supernatural. It may be that with the final lesson of correction located in the constellation of the twins, and that's coming up toward the end of this year, some revelations or discoveries concerning the double could emerge. I certainly anticipate that. But the generation of a human animal via their own double is what Sophia intended. Nevertheless, she did not, and that's mitotic. Nevertheless, she did not intend that to be an act to occur entirely independent of an intergender connection. So the intergender connection between the male and female of the animal species, the human animal, would generate the basis and excitement that would allow the individual animals, male and female, to reproduce themselves by generating their double. This is a tentative picture of what might be considered as the plan for human reproduction in Sophia's original dreaming of this experiment. So I leave that with you for what it's worth. And from time to time, we'll have to go back and revisit that concept and revise it. So on that note, I'll begin this audio commentary for Crew Notes 23. And as you're listening, you may want to bring up Myth in Progress on metahistory.org and scan down the text. You see there that I present a link to a YouTube clip on M42. This is some kind of archontic simulation developed from Hubble photographs. And you want to note at the beginning of that clip that what you are looking at is what you can actually see with the naked eye. That is to say, that section of the third galactic arm in which the Earth and solar system are embedded. In the clip, you get the impression that you're looking at it from outside, but actually we are within the arm. And we can see the narrow area of the arm, the definition of the arm, based on the population of stars in a narrow margin. And that is called the Milky Way. It's the edge of the third galactic arm. And you see that the constellation of Orion actually hangs off it in a curious way that attracts your attention. And when you look in that direction, you are looking in the direction in which the galactic arms unwind and dissipate, which is opposite the direction of movement upstream of the solar system. The Pleiades, or the Pleiromic Relay Spindle, is located on the other side or edge, the outer edge, of the same galactic limb where Orion is seen to be hanging. And of course, the Orion Nebula, N42, is located in part of the constellation of Orion. And the principal star formation within the Orion Nebula is called the Trapezium, which is a point not noted on the clip. I've also supplied a clip to another YouTube phenomenon, which are these talks, some of them quite elaborate, of this fellow named Danny Wilton. And I deliberately include this 10-minute clip for you to get an idea of his exposition and as a way to illustrate what is wrong with the way people handle cosmic or cosmological phenomena. Seeing animations in the photographic plates of the Orion Nebula is not an exercise in planetary tantra. And what Danny Wilton is doing is inventing or picturing these animations when he looks at photographs of the Orion Nebula. This is not a valid practice. The practice is to go out at night, stand on the earth in nature, look at the sky, and look at the Orion Nebula with your naked eye. And use the power of animation of your own imagination to picture what is in the Orion Nebula. So when you look at the Orion Nebula, the first, which is an act of observation, the first addition to that act is the imagination of the Anthropos template suspended within the trapezium stars. Start with that visualization. That is the visualization of the Teleste, of the mysteries. From observing the sky, they determined that Sophia and Thelete, with the support of the entire Aeonic company behind them, embedded the plasmic template of the human species in that location. That is the proper use of the power of animation of your own mind. And what Danny Wilton is doing is, I don't even want to comment further. I find it not only irritating, but suspicious. You know? So I asked the question, do these quasi-hallucinations discredit interest in M42 as related to the Sophianic mythos? Is this intentional disinfo? I suspect that it may be. There's a couple of other things, two other comments I would make on the presentations of Danny Wilton, which are now receiving a fair amount of circulation on the internet, as far as I can tell. In the first place, Wilton devotes a considerable amount of time to the study of certain paintings and frescoes in Catholic churches. He operates on the claim that these frescoes showing heavenly scenes actually contain accurate graphic representations of the Orion Nebula. And since these religious paintings were done some centuries ago, they anticipate the current photographic evidence. And so he compares the photographic evidence from Hubble and other sources to these paintings. It's up to you if you find these comparisons to be valid. He juxtaposes current photographic evidence of the shape and design of the Orion Nebula with certain of these celestial scenes on the roofs of cathedrals, the ceilings of cathedrals, excuse me. Do you find that convincing? I really don't find it convincing. But even if it is convincing, what is he trying to say? I find it troubling that while he makes the claim of being independent of any religious affiliation, he claims to be an independent investigator, I find it troubling that the strong inference of his research is that people in the Catholic Church, and Jesuits in particular, had this photographically correct intel on the Orion Nebula centuries before modern science achieved it. I find this to be a troubling, bothersome inference. I don't like this inference because it gives power to the Catholic Church and gives power to secret organizations. And it is always a mistake to give power to these secret organizations. Secondly, what troubles me about Wilton's presentation is that he does not appear in any of the material that I've listened to make reference to my statement in Not in His Image, which was published in November 2006, that the seers of the mystery schools themselves identified M42 as the nesting locale for the human genome, if you will. I mean, that is as clear and direct a statement as you can get. It doesn't get any clearer than that. And here, however, is Danny Wilton saying, we must assume by the presence of these ceiling decorations that the Jesuits knew all about Orion and that they, by a further inference, that they understood that in some respect the template for the human species derives from that locale. Where is he getting that notion? First of all, those are two different notions, aren't they? You might be able to prove by graphic comparison that these ceiling paintings do indeed resemble the Orion Nebula in ways that are striking or remarkable. That's would be QED, something to be demonstrated. But it's a further inference from that point on to claim that the existence of such illustrations in religious art points to the knowledge that the human species in some respect originated from the Orion Nebula. Where does he get that idea? Did it just appear in his head as he was making his independent investigations? In any case, I don't know, and I don't want to dwell on it any further. But for those of you on the crew who have not yet come across the talks and video clips of Danny Wilton, I wanted to alert you to the presence of this information. And I don't need to warn you about disinformation. You have the discernment and discrimination to evaluate such matters. I'm certain of that. But I will say that I consider his elaborate description of body parts and floating eyes and dinosaurs and bones in the visual detail of the Orion Nebula to be an extremely misleading and ridiculous, to the point where I wonder if it might not be a deliberate ploy in order to cast a discrediting veil over the subject of the Orion Nebula. You know how this works. It's been done a lot with 9/11. For instance, people cast a discrediting or dissembling veil over the work of Dr. Judy Wood by claiming that she proposed that space beams launched from flying saucers disintegrated the Twin Towers. And so someone who hears that story will dismiss it as ridiculous and will not be inclined to go on and investigate her evidence. Likewise, someone who listens to Danny Wilton's elaborate descriptions of animal parts and body parts that he finds in the granular detail of photographs of the Orion Nebula may be inclined to dismiss the proposition that the Orion Nebula is in some respect the origin of human evolution. And that is the danger presented by the kind of work, if you want to call it that, by the kind of research that Danny Wilton is presenting. So to move ahead into the core material of this commentary, I'm scrolling down here to the section of the text entitled Revisionist Cosmology, and picking up the key theme relating to the topic of topics, which is the central riddle of correction. Let's note once again how the central riddle of correction generates a series of questions that prompt human imagination, with each prompt leading to new insight and improved recall of our remote past on this planet. We achieve another degree of participation with the wisdom goddess. For instance, the riddle generates this question. In her pleromic or pre-plunge dreaming of the experiment with Anthropos 10, when Sophia previewed her intervention, did she conceive it to be independent of human participation or reliant upon it? In other words, do the anomalous conditions of the experiment after her plunge change the dynamics of her intervention, involving human collaboration in a way that would otherwise not have applied? And if so, how so? Well, the myth itself already answers this question in one respect. In Episode 6, FGS 1.0 follows the surviving textual sources, in particular one Nag Hammadi document called On the Origin of the World, relating how the Aeon Sophia, acting outside the Pleroma, modified the original calibration of the Anthropos by infusing it with the luminous Epinoia for the specific purpose of providing a faculty to be used to defeat the Archons. Now, you'll see on the metahistory page that I cited the relevant passages here. At the risk of being tedious, I want to take you through some points that are actually found in the existing Coptic material. The reason why I want to do that is not to rub your nose in this dog's breakfast called the Nag Hammadi Library, but to give you a sense, if you wish, of knowing exactly where we're coming from in those materials. Remember that FGS 1.0 is where we start out, and that is the restored form of the Sophianic narrative of the mysteries. If you are now developing this myth with me, then you would do well to know exactly where the key textual points can be found and where we depart from those points in the further augmentation, elaboration, and extrapolation of the myth. Okay? So let me just take a moment to cruise you through that. Three key passages are cited here. One is from the Origin of the World, and there are two more from the Apocryphon of John, followed finally by a passage from the 11th Codex, the second book in the 11th Codex, a Valentinian exposition. Now, there is also another text called the Hypothesis of the Archons, which contains more cosmological material that is closely related to the three texts cited here. Okay? I want to show you exactly where certain key terms can be found and then how I have extrapolated from those terms. As I do so, you will come to see that I have made a certain association in the narrative that is not directly present in the textual material. It's an assumed or inferred association. What is that association? It is the association that Sophia's challenge to the Archons, namely that we, the Anthropos, would overcome them at the consummation of their works, occurred in the same sequence of events when Sophia endowed the luminous Epinoia into the Anthropos. Now, we assume, as you know, that the luminous Epinoia was not originally present in the calibration of the Anthropos in the form that it is in us today. The power of imagination that we have today is actually an add-on to our original endowment. At least this is my interpretation based on these critical but extremely sparse and fragmentary passages. And so I am associating this additional factor of the luminous Epinoia with the episode where Sophia challenges the Archons, as well as with the episode where Sophia produces, out of her own powers, her daughter, that is to say, her female emanation, named Zoe, which is the flame-born daughter of Sophia, and may be associated with the power of everlasting life and with certain processes in the human genetic makeup, such as the presence of biophotonic activity in the ribosomes of the human body and so forth. So I've written extensively about this, and I want you to know that all of this material is a merge that arises in FGS 2.0 and further in FGS 3.0. And even though the elements from which this merge is constructed can be seen in the text, the actual merge of these events into the plot in FGS 3.0 does not occur in the text, and you cannot find anywhere a single and coherent citation which will support these associations. So just want you to bear that in mind. Now, all of this happens in episode 6. Episode 6, called The Star is Born, is by far the most action packed episode of the Sophianic narrative regarding events that are difficult to comprehend and difficult, if not impossible, to put in any kind of linear order. And you'll see further down on this page in metahistory.org that I have indicated the complexity of the events scrambled together in episode 6. So going directly back to the text, you see the two short passages from the Apocryphon of John, one in section 14 and a following one in section 20. They both refer to the correction of the Aeon Sophia, but they do not use the word for correction, diorthosis, that is the noun. They use the verbs referring to the act of correction, which in Coptic are different words. Nevertheless, it is clear that both passages, and particularly the second passage, I should say, connect the power of the luminous epinoia intimately with Sophia's correction. And the luminous epinoia was hidden in Adam in order that the archons might not reach that power, and that the epinoia might assist the correction of the deprivation of Sophia. By deprivation or defect, the text indicates Sophia's separation from the Pleroma, her autistic condition, due to the complete absorption of her aeonic powers in the act of material immanence, the act of terrestrialization, to coin a term, turning into a planet. So there you have it, and naturally you're going to ask, well, if the word for correction, the noun, does not appear in any of these crucial passages which refer to Sophia's dilemma, where actually does it occur? Well, the bad news is that it occurs in an extremely corrupt text in the Nag Hammadi corpus. In the first place, a Valentinian exposition is not Sethian Gnostic material. As you know, I draw the reconstruction of the Sophianic narrative largely from Sethian sources, Sethian Gnostics, and not from Valentinian Gnostics. So Valentinus was an Alexandrian Gnostic who attempted to make a compromise with the rising ideology of Christianity and the savior mythos. And so the Valentinian version of the myth is biased, slanted, or spun in that direction and is not consistent with the Sethian character of the reconstruction, as I've worked it out. Secondly, the Valentinian exposition is a short document in rather bad condition. Some passages are entirely missing. Some passages are illegible. There are many gaps. And so there's a multitude of problems with the Valentinian exposition, but nevertheless, it is the one text in the corpus which uses the word diorthosis, which is a Greek word. And the passage, which you'll find in the Nag Hammadi Library in English on page 485, goes like this. Since it is a perfect form that should ascend into the Pleroma, he did not at all want to consent to the suffering, but he was detained him by limit, that is, by the syzygy, since her correction will not occur through anyone except her son, whose alone is fullness of divinity. End quote. Now, if that isn't something like a schizophrenic bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich, I don't know what is. This passage, probably better than any other I could cite, gives you some idea of what it requires to go through this material with a fine-tooth comb and pull together some kind of coherent narrative. There are meaningless or indeterminable reference in this passage. This occurs often in Coptic material. For instance, there is a reference to a being that did not consent to the suffering, but was detained by the limit, and this is associated with the syzygy. Well, this is indicative of these lines are indicative of the Valentinian spin. And in the Valentinian spin, Christos is taken to be the consort or syzygy of the divine Sophia. And in turn, Christos, the Valentinians assigned to Christos the role of intercession, of course, but they confused the intercession, or they melded the intercession of the Christos, which has already occurred in cosmical history, with the act of correction which is due to occur. So you find here in this unfortunate passage, which at the same time is a supremely important passage because it contains the word diorthosis, you find here the confounding of the Christic intercession with Sophia's act of correction, and you find that the Aeon Christos, according to the view of the Valentinians, participates uniquely in both of these events. Well, we'll see about that. In fact, we are right now at the moment in correction when the confusion regarding these textual sources can be resolved once and for all. Also, you'll note in that passage that it says her correction will not occur through anything except her son. Well, you know, Shere, S-H-E-R-E in Coptic. Well, who is her son? Is Christos her son? No, Christos, the Aeon Christos, is her syzygy, that is to say, partner or counterpart, but not the syzygy in the pleroma that propagates the human genome. According to the Sethian view, that syzygy consists of Sophia and Thelete. So there is another sort of partnering of aeons when the Aeon Christos intercedes, and that occurs, as we know, in episode 7 of the narrative. So preceding episode 7 is the action-packed but deeply jumbled episode 6, and preceding that is episode 5. And I'd like to bring your attention now, as we move into the depths of the narrative, to something that occurs in episode 5, which may not, up until this point, have been clear in your mind. And I want to clarify this event in episode 5 so that we can proceed on the same page with some of the amendments and extrapolations of the narrative in the next 12 months. Looking once again to the surviving sources. Now remember, this sequence we're considering now belongs actually to FGS 1.0, because everything in FGS 1.0 comes directly from the surviving text. On the origin of the world, in passage 102, you find a description of a monumental cosmic event that happened in the pre-terrestrial phase of cosmology. And they, the realms of the celestial mechanics, which are the habitat and containment for the archons, were completed from this heaven up to as far as the sixth heaven, namely that of Sophia. But, and I would add the but, the heaven and his earth, that is, of the Archon Overlord, the Demiurge, were destroyed by the troublemaker who is below them all, which oddly turns out to be the Demiurge himself. Now, this is a remarkable passage. For one thing, it suggests that there was an earth or some sort of earth present in a solar system constructed by the Archons prior to the current solar system. And what would this earth have been? Well, in one text, it is called, it is compared to a footstool. Also, in the same sequence, in two different cosmological treatises, the Coptic material says that when Sophia realized that the Archons were there and that the Lord Archon, that is to say the reptilian overlord type, had established his supremacy over the hive of neonate or embryonic type Archons, to put it into the science fiction idiom of today, she hid them in a cloud, and she hid the Lord Archon, who was blind, who is called Saklesar Samael, this blind demonic entity inadvertently produced from the impact of her organic light upon the Dima of the galactic arms. So it is possible to imagine that in the first archontic heaven, Yaldabaoth had a sort of earth provided for him. That is to say, a celestial throne. He had a celestial throne, probably in the region of what we now call Saturn. And surrounding this celestial throne were the mansions created for him by his archontic minions, you see? But that entire structure was destroyed by the troublemaker who is below them all, which I don't know how you would interpret that passage, but I interpret it to mean that the Demiurge himself did not provide what was necessary to sustain this world, to sustain this world system, which Sophia allowed the Archons to construct by loaning them part of her aeonic power. So, the first archonic cosmos, or stereoma, collapsed due to structural failure. And I would place this event in episode 5 of the narrative. Then in episode 6, the Aeon Sophia, now supported by the assistance of the mother star, Sabaoth, took measures for another archontic cosmos to arise, including a planet that would stabilize the structural and dynamic properties of the entire system. And so the text reads in the following passage, same text, quote, since that day, the heaven of the Archons, along with its earth, the planet to be supplied by Sophia, has consolidated itself through Sophia, the daughter of Yaldabaoth, she who is below or at the source of them all. Of course, end quote. Of course, this is again baffling because here Sophia is called the daughter of Yaldabaoth. In other passages, she's called the mother of Yaldabaoth and the Archons. She cannot be both their mother and daughter, and most certainly is not the latter. So I would make that line out to be a scribal error, just as anyone could easily make in a rapid stress transcription of oral discourse. Confusions of references to son and daughter run through all the Coptic materials, as we noted also in the passage from a Valentinian exposition, who is the son to which that passage refers. S-O-N. I couldn't say. It really makes no sense when you step back and look at it in a coherent and consistent narrative. It makes no sense. So there you are, folks. We are stuck with editing these materials to the best of our ability. And I want to take you along for the ride here at the risk of boring you with the tedium required to sort through these Coptic materials. Finally, I'd like to add a comment on the detail in the above passage that says Sophia is in the sixth. Now, the sixth is memory jargon for the first hexagonally structured archonic cosmos centered on Saturn. Note today the mysterious occurrence of a hexagonal structure on Saturn, a massive hexagonal structure, and I provide a link there to a YouTube clip. So during that moment of cosmological time, when the Aeon Sophia is dealing with the construction and subsequent collapse of the first archontic heaven, she herself is in the realm of the archons, the realm that she has designated for them as a containment facility, as it were. The solar system is a containment facility for the archons. And so she is in the sixth. In that first archontic cosmos, Saturn was at the center of the celestial mechanics. There was no sun, and there was no earth as such. Although, as I just said, we might presume that there was a throne of some kind upon Saturn, and there sat Yaldabaoth until the whole thing collapsed. Okay, now proceeding to record with the built-in microphone of the Mac because I just got a wicked buzz on the headset and I don't know what to do about it. So here we go. Fascinating image there. Yaldabaoth sitting on a throne atop of Saturn, a sixfold hexagonal cosmos of celestial mechanics. The way it plays in my imagination is I could see her putting him in a cage, you know? There's a theme that occurs in some science fiction films. I'm thinking particularly of one of the Superman films. There you see some people on another galaxy who were convicted of some crimes against the inhabitants of that galaxy, and so they were put into some kind of virtual prism, which was represented as a fragment of a mirror, I think, a rhomboid fragment of a mirror, and they were cast into this virtual prison and held prisoner there, and they managed to escape and get loose on the Earth and cause mayhem, and Superman had to come and save the day. So this is a science fiction theme. I'm sure you can think of other films as well that have used it. So I can well consider that in her first attempt to corral the archons and keep them out of her hair, literally, the Aeon Sophia caged him on a kind of pedestal to suit his arrogance and left him there at the center of the archon cosmos, and maybe he just shook his cage too much in his rage and in his false empowerment of being the sole creator god, he shook his cage and he brought the whole system down. So it had to be reconstructed. And as I explain here on the text, when this reconstruction occurred, the cosmos that arose exhibits two centers. It is a celestial mechanics operating on elliptical principles. So there are two dwell points, one established by the Earth and one established by the Sun. And so each planetary orbit as well has two dwell points, which are the two foci of the elliptical orbit of those planets. Okay? Now I'm back to the headset, having repaired it using some nanobots that I called in from the other side of Pluto. They seem to be quite efficient little critters, these nanobots. Now, in winding up this overview of the revisions of the sacred narrative, I thought I would include a revised framework of the nine planetary realms adopted or adapted for our purposes. And so here we go, just so you can be clear in any future references to these realms, and also on the far possibility that this ninefold schema might in some way assist us in further clarification of events transpiring on the cosmological scale. The realm of the ninth is the Earth itself, the terrestrial zone, the livable habitat of the Earth, which is the planetary laboratory for a divine experiment with Anthropos 10. The ninth is the planetary body of the Aeon Sophia and the domain of correction. The eighth is the realm of the zodiac, fixed stars or constellations, also called the Ogdoad. The seventh is the realm of the sun, the mother star, Sabaoth. And I quote, "The mother star Sabaoth sung praises to Sophia and her daughter Zoe, and they together caught her up to the heights and gave her charge of the seventh heaven," end quote. This is from the Hypostasis of the Archons, or the Reality of the Archons. And it is from Nag Hammadi Library in English, page 168. Six is the realm of Saturn, which is hexagonal, and also refers to the sexagesimal or six base measure of time used in mundane astronomy, clocks, and calendrics. Now, don't be confused, because you may occasionally encounter the association of Saturn with the Hebdomad. In fact, some Gnostic sources associate Saturn with the so-called Hebdomad, which is again associated with Yaldabaoth, and that means a sevenfold realm. But we have assigned a sevenfold realm to the sun, the mother star, and I am fairly certain that that designation will stick and prove to be fruitful in the future. So how come the sixfold realm of Saturn, with its hexagonal signature, can also be associated in some way or identified in some way with the Hebdomad, which is a seven structure? Well, quite simply because when you include the Earth within the realm of Saturn, then you have seven factors. You have Mercury, Venus, the Moon, the Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Seven factors. And so, since Saturn defines the boundary of the Archonic solar system and is associated with the Archon Overlord, we can say that Saturn functions in a hebdomadic fashion, even though we assign the number six to the heaven of Saturn. Clear enough? Five is the heaven or realm of Jupiter, the fifth heaven. Four, the realm of Mars. Three, the lunar realm. Two, the realm of Venus. And one, the realm of Mercury. Now, there are various other permutations one could make. In fact, you can go on and make as many permutations as you like. But one thing that I try to avoid, not only in the GNE, but also in Planetary Tantra, is an excess of abstractions, metaphysical systems, and male mind permutations. So I propose this ninefold structure for its simplicity, for its obviousness, and for its future utility in the development of our sacred narrative. Thank you very much. So it's steady as she goes as we come around to the home stretch of this audio commentary. The next subheading in the essay on metahistory is Dangerous Idea. And you'll see there that I've pulled two paragraphs out of Not in His Image, referring to Lovelock's assertion or warning that when you have Gaia theory, a sentient Gaia able to control the Earth consciously is not inherent to that theory, nor is it possible. So Lovelock, who I think declined very seriously as far as his mental faculties were concerned in his later years and really went off the deep end, abjured the notion that Gaia could be sentient, conscious, and could regulate her own activities in the way that an animal does, any animal that is conscious, whether it be a cat or a human animal. And so I want to indicate there that the Gnostic notion of the correction of the Earth goddess does indeed propose that she is sentient conscious and self-conscious, and not only that, but of course that she is telestic. And so the issue of teleology or goal orientation, known as strong Gaia theory, that was left unresolved, has been left unresolved to this day, is actually resolved, can be resolved in the Gnostic cosmology of the earth. Okay, oh happy day. Now, going down to the next few paragraphs, I have a little more to say about the dangerous idea. You know, I was thinking lately about how I would speak now about correction or Sophianic cosmology and things of that sort were I to talk in a public arena. And for various reasons, since the Dumavadi date and the removal of certain pretenses, other pretenses have come into play. I told you how it works. And consistent with that change, I've been contemplating my delivery as it might be expressed, other than in this current theater, which we're calling the GNE. And one day while I was taking a bath, it often happens to me while I'm taking baths, I go into a kind of internal dialogue or internal monologue, if you will. Never know what to call it. So I go into a monologue, okay? Talking to myself, but actually, no, I really don't like to talk to myself. I prefer the internal dialogue. So when I find myself going into a mental riff like that, I immediately turn it around and act as if I am addressing some particular individual or group of people or even the world at large or even humanity or the Pleromic Aeons or whatever, as long as it's a dialogue and not a monologue. So recently I went into a dialogue that was based on the theme of the most dangerous idea in the world, which could be the title of a talk. And were that to be the case, a public talk, then I would say to my audience, I'm going to tell you what is the most dangerous idea in the world, but I'm also going to give you the evidence to conclude for yourself whether or not it is what I call it. I am going to present my argument in this way, just as I present it to you in these two or three paragraphs of synopsis. There is a certain idea which I draw from suppressed material out of the Gnostic tradition. I'm not making up this idea. This is an idea that can be found in surviving materials. And it is the idea that the planet Earth is the expression in material immanence of a divinity from the galactic core who is fully capable of self-conscious, sentient, and teleological actions, and who, in addition, wishes to be interactive with the human species, who holds the human species as the primary subject of a divine experiment occurring on Earth, and in turn, who wishes that the correction of that experiment, which has gone badly wrong, be achieved in a collaboration between herself, namely the Aeon Sophia, and humanity, namely the Anthropos, of which she is the co-generator. That's the idea, not my idea. My paraphrase and my syntax for the supreme idea of the mysteries of pre-Christian Europe, okay? Now, how can I prove to you, or how would I prove in a talk to the public that this is the most dangerous idea in the world? Well, I would prove it by the measure of what has been required historically to repress this idea and to make it seem as if it did not exist and never existed in the first place, or if that is not possible, and it turned out not to be, to make it appear that this idea is demented, absurd, fantastical beyond belief, and should be rejected on face value, as was argued by a number of the church fathers or early Christian ideologues. So, what would I then proceed to do? I would proceed to describe the actual events that transpired in particular places in this world over a number of centuries in an attempt to repress this idea. And I would leave it to the audience themselves to infer from the scope and ferocity, the murderous ferocity of these events and actions, I leave it to the audience to infer the scope and power of that which was being attacked, okay? So the first instance from Western history, the history of Western civilization, would be the Christian attack on the mysteries, which ensued for centuries from about 150 AD, the period of the document by Justin Martyr, or attributed to Justin Martyr. The first arguments against the heresies, the heretics, or the Gnostics appeared in writing at that time, indicative of the fact that there was an open dialogue with the Teleste of the mystery centers. The attack on the mysteries that ensued from that moment up through the death of Hypatia in 415, all through the next six centuries of the diaspora of the Teleste into the far reaches of Western Europe, England, Scotland, and Wales, through the period of the Inquisition, way up into the period of the witch trials, and right up to the border of the Renaissance. Consider that long trajectory of events, and consider that one of the abiding themes that persisted through all of those centuries was the destruction of the mysteries and the destruction of the Sophianic vision of life. And so I argue, I submit to you, first, because I'm rehearsing this with you, obviously. I'm dialoguing with you because I'd rather do that than monologue in my bathtub, although Nikki's always hanging over me on the sink there looking down, ready to enter the dialogue at any time that I might need her. But I'm rehearsing this on you, and I would argue to the public that the measure of this immense and long-term effort in material destruction and human and cultural and intellectual genocide and murder and the repression of the indigenous genius that was fostered by the Sophianic vision is also the measure of the power of that vision. Second instance from history that I would draw directly from history as proof of the power of the Sophianic vision would be the events in Russia from about 1880 into the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, into the 20th century, into the period of the First Revolution, 1905, the Popular Revolution, then the Second Revolution, hijacked by the Jewish Bolsheviks in the service of international bankers, and carrying through into the Stalinist era and the Gulag, and so forth. The Ukrainian genocide, one of Stalin's first and eminent achievements, totally engineered by Jewish ideologues in the Communist Party. And I would take that range of events, say from 1880 up until about, say, 1950, beginning of the post-Stalinist era, and I would cite the record, what I call a spectacular rampage of murder, torture, and terror that is estimated to have taken at least 60 to 80 million lives. It took so many lives that they cannot even be estimated. It makes the figures of the Jewish Holocaust look like a drop in the bucket of blood. And so I would explain that in the Bolshevik communist ideology that occurred in China, where Maoism racked up bodies in equal quantities, and in the explosions of Marxist communism around the world, we see the demonstration of a force erupting in the human mind and in human society that is hell-bent on destroying the Sophianic vision of the mysteries. And the extent to which the adherence of these programs go is the extent, reflects the extent of what they are resisting and what they are attempting to destroy. And so I would say that on the basis of that, those historical, two historical scenarios, that you can get some idea of how dangerous it is to the psychopaths on this planet if there is even the faintest hint of the resurgence of the Sophianic vision of life and the return to the mysteries of the living earth, including human interactivity with the earth goddess, and including the central methodology of the mysteries, that is to say, instruction by the organic light. And once again, since the discovery of the Nag Hammadi codices, since the translation into English in the mid-70s, and since the reconstruction of the sacred narrative in the early years of the 21st century, the psychopaths and those who implement Marxist communist agendas are once again under threat of the resurgence of humanity's spiritual birthright. And so we are, as participants in the GNE and devotees of planetary tantra, on the front line of this confrontation. And I want to stress in the conclusion, in just concluding this comment, this audio commentary, I want to highlight for you two crucial realizations to carry with you at this point in the Gaian navigation experiment. The first one is, the power of the sacred narrative is the sole guiding force that can direct human imagination into alignment with Sophia's correction. You already know that. The second point is, and here I am quite proud and happy to make this assertion, grafting the fallen goddess scenario onto a geological and historical timeline, as the NAV has recently done, brings the full power of the narrative down into the reach and range of prehistory and from there into historical memory. So, I consider this nifty conjuncture on the mytho-historical gradient to reflect the two-armed recall process indicated by the action of the lunar nodes during correction. Remember that I said some while back, about a year into correction, that I haven't been giving you discrete intel on the lunar nodes, but more and more, as correction proceeds, and as we are more deeply embedded in the process, we recognize that the operation of these lunar nodes is stirring up ancestral and indigenous memory. And it is from the memory of our true origins, going back to the Orion men and the arboreal nymphs of Gaia, going back to the moment when the Anthropos plasm originally spawned in the oceans of this planet and then gradually proceeded to the land, going back to that moment and coming forward again to the mysteries of prehistory and down into this kalpa, which began about 24,000 years ago, 26,000 years ago, 24,000 BC, and then ahead from there through historical time to the present moment. This coherence, this continuity is what she wants of us, because we are the memory circuit in her mind. I said that originally when I wrote Sharing the Gaia Mythos, and I say it again now with more conviction than ever, and I say it thanks to you with the certainty that we can prove it. I do not say, mind you, that the human species is the totality of her memory. No. For instance, the ocean, the oceans of this planet, and the oceanic processes and cycles represent her emotional memory. Other aspects of nature including tree rings, including the mineralogical and geological deposits that can be read in the earth, represent other factors or aspects of her memory. But humanity represents uniquely that minute circuit in her memory through which she herself can have an historical continuity of perspective. History is something of human making, obviously. History is a product of the anthropos. It is a product of human imagination based on the observation and recording of events combined with our narrative capacity, which is the power of the eye of the bull, the power of narrative imagination. And these capacities are what establish the human species as a unique, tiny circuit in the entire mind of the planet. And upon that one tiny circuit in her mind depends the crucial factor of historical continuity that we provide to her through our memory and through access to her phylogenetic and transpersonal memories, which are actually our memories, which she preserves for us. And so, I am immensely proud that through working with you in the GNE, I have been able to make this graft and actually to graft the fallen goddess scenario mythology down into prehistory and bring it forward, even using the method of precessional timing, bring it forward into this kalpa. I mean, that is a tremendous achievement. I consider this achievement to be as great as the discovery of the celestial anchor and the demonstration of pleromic relay. It is another fantastic achievement of the Gaia navigation experiment, and I am extremely happy about it. So on that note, I leave you with this summary and a brief quotation from the text. In episode 7 occurs the shearing of the Anthropos template, that is the penultimate event that occurs cosmologically before the complete materialization of Sophia's organic light forming the planet. So the complete terrestrial morph begins at the end of episode 7 and is completed in the beginning of the episode 8, and it is at that moment, that is the episode of the Christic Intercession, that the assistance of that Sophia requires the assistance of the Aeon Christos. And wonder of wonders, this is the first event in the entire narrative of 9 episodes that I would dare to date according to the existing geological framework. Now, I don't say that the existing geological framework is true or correct, but it is the mental structure that we have to use. And so its utility is what matters more than its absolute veracity. Its absolute and final veracity or relative veracity is a matter to be determined. But its utility for the processes of story building is excellent. So I would put in episode 8, the Christic Intercession, the Cambrian explosion, said to have occurred between 585 and 550 million years ago, MYA. Then there is a lapse from the Cambrian explosion into the Mesozoic era and a supposed extinction. Remember, an extinction is not the end of life on Earth. It is a sorting out process. It is a selection of viable programs. And sometime during that period of 300 or so million years between the Cambrian explosion and the Mesozoic era came the encounter between the Gaian women, who were the only human inhabitants of the planet, and the men from Orion, and I describe that event in these terms. Immediately after the extinction of the Mesozoic era, 250 million years ago, come the ancestral mammals, as they are called, cynodonts, followed by a lumbering troop of dinosaurs, followed by Sleeping Beauty and the Seven Dwarfs. So when, in this immense perspective, did the Thonian romance begin? When did the Gaian women, in particular the arboreal nymphs, first encounter their male counterparts from Orion without the recognition that they were counterparts sheared from the same genomic plasm? When? I can only venture a guess, Mimetes, not so far substantiated by fresh and recent practices in shamanic trance, allowing access to phylogenetic memory banks. Not yet. Let's imagine, tentatively, that the Orion men, in fully developed but streamlined human anatomy, see those Cycladian sculptures, alongside arboreal women of the Artemis type, hunted together during the epoch when dinosaurs roamed this earth. Boy meets girl, then, rather recently in the Sophianic plotline, a mere 250 million years ago. That would be the moment of the first fateful clinch of human genders, 200 million years before the first primates are thought to have appeared, around 50 million years ago in the Cenozoic era. In Gaia's own lifespan, the encounter occurs just when she reaches the threshold of puberty, marked by the appearance of flowering plants, the angiosperms, simultaneously with large placental animals. And this occurred in the so-called Cretaceous era. Good gracious, it's the Cretaceous. Time to get laid.